Les séminaires du Collège de France.
J'ai le grand plaisir de vous présenter le professeur Giuseppe Longobardi, anniversary professor à l'Université de York. Giuseppe ou Pino Longobardi a étudié à l'École normale supérieure de Pise, à l'Université de Pise, aussi à Paris, comme boursier d'échange avec l'École normale de la rue d'Ulm. On a tous eu cette expérience importante. Il a été professeur de linguistique à Venise, à Trieste, et maintenant, dans les derniers 10 ans, gros, à York. C'est un grand syntacticien, un spécialiste de syntaxe comparative. Il a donné beaucoup de contributions marquantes, en particulier dans la dernière, je dirais, quinzaine d'années, ou peut-être un peu plus. Il propose un modèle très original de comparaison linguistique, aussi pour l'étude de la diachronie profonde de langue, qui n'est pas basée sur les ressemblances lexicales, comme la méthode classique, mais sur les propriétés de variation syntaxique, sur les paramètres. Je n'ai pas eu le temps d'introduire cette notion, donc il devra le faire lui-même dans sa présentation. Donc merci beaucoup, Pino, et bienvenue à Paris.
Merci. Bonjour à tous. Je vais donner ma conférence en anglais, mais ensuite vous pouvez poser toute question en français, et je peux vous répondre en français, d'accord? Et je donne la conférence en anglais pour des raisons, disons, soit de captation et soit de terminologie technique de la phylogénétique linguistique. D'accord. Ok, so, I will try to start from a general problem which goes much beyond the normal scope of linguistics, of the study of language. And this is the problem of whether it is possible to do history as a science. This is a problem which has been particularly carefully addressed at the end of a famous book by Jerry Diamond, the ornithologist and anthropologist at the same time, at the University of California, at Los Angeles. His famous book is called what's the English word? I think it's
Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Yeah, Guns, Germs, and Steel. Okay, yeah, I never remember the order of the words in the English version. Okay, and in the epilogue of his famous book, he raises this problem and tries to state some conditions which could make history possible as a scientific discipline. Of course, as any science, history should try to identify some network of regularities. And as linguists, we can say that the more abstract, in general, these regularities are, the better to approach the domain in a historical fashion, in a scientific and historical fashion. Then, of course, the domain in question must have a sufficient degree of variability across time and space, because otherwise you cannot talk about history, of course. And then, as for every science, at least since the scientific revolution of the 17th century, in order to have a really scientific approach, it is necessary for the domain to be subject in principle to some kind of quantitative modeling. And finally, and this is the main point in Diamond's statement of the problem, it is necessary to be able to study a domain for a long period of time, okay? And this strategy is very important in order to avoid accidental factors in the development of history, which may somehow obscure the general long-time regularities. And actually, the subtitle of his book is a history of the last 10,000 years. Okay, and that's the time dimension, the time size that he tends to consider, which a time size, which time depth, which goes even beyond the one of other classical approaches to long time history, for instance, Braudel's notion of histoire de longue durée. Okay, so this is why I took Diamond's viewpoint as my point of departure. And I will try to discuss how linguistics and cognitive science, so a modern approach to linguistics, may contribute to this kind of enterprise. Okay, fine. So let's take one point into consideration. Over the past 20 years, there has been 20, 25 years, there has been a big revolution in historical linguistics, and especially in phylogenetic linguistics, in the kind of linguistics which tries to reconstruct the genealogical trees of languages and reconstruct the ancestors of present-day languages. And this quantitative revolution has been very important in reshaping the methods of the field, but the input data which are being used throughout the various approaches of this general quantitative framework have not really changed. And they are largely the same as were provided by classical historical linguistics, and most of them were essentially ready in type and even in token at the end of the 19th century. And this type of input data is essentially lexical etymologies. So relationships among words with similar meanings across different languages, and some kind of similar form. Now, this kind of work, which, looking for the etymologies of words in trying to reconstruct their ancestors and trying to reconstruct the relationships of languages by comparing the words, has been very important in the 19th century, and the method which was developed at the time was already somehow scientific in the sense of satisfying the first point of the first condition for scientific history, namely the identification of abstract regularities. For instance, one point which is very important is that two words in two different languages may be very similar in form and meaning, but this does not mean anything in terms of their etymology unless you find a systematic relationship between sounds in their distribution within the words. For instance, a very good example is the one of Spanish mucho, which means much, of course, and English much, which, especially in the part of England where I work, is pronounced much, actually. So much and mucho are very similar, okay? And actually, even the so-called règle du trois that Antoine Meillet, the famous French comparativist, suggested, namely that a reasonable Indo-European etymology had to be based on three instances of a certain word in three different languages, is falsified in this case, because, for instance, in other parts of Italy, where I where I worked in the past, much is often, or is often said, un mucho de, which means a lot of. So one could simply take this un mucho de of northeastern Italian, much of Spanish, much of northern England, and decide that you have three words which are almost identical in form and identical in meaning, but this means nothing in terms of etymology because the three words have completely different etymologies. Okay, so instead, what the classical historical linguists have shown is that something much more abstract than that is what really counts in defining the relatedness of words across different languages and, as a consequence, the relatedness of these languages. So, for instance, just as a simple example, there are many, many words, for instance, in French where you find the diphthong wa written O-O-I, and these words correspond to a closed A in Italian, okay, from some long A in Latin, and this is true in words like roi, toile, voile, and there are many others that one could cite. And it is this particular relationship between two sounds, which are not even very similar from the physical viewpoint, but have the same distribution across many words in the vocabularies of two languages, which really proves the relatedness of two or more languages. Okay, so the point is that the quantitative revolution which has taken place over the past 20-25 years in historical linguistics has not radically changed this kind of approach and the kind of data which support its conclusions. So what's the problem with that? Well, of course, I've just said, I mean, that's certainly a scientific approach. There is a lot to recommend to it, but it has a sort of intrinsic limit, intrinsic problem. Namely, this kind of regular sound correspondences across languages tends to become blurred, to become irretrievable after a certain number of years, actually a certain number of millennia. Of course, it's not completely clear what is the bottom limit of this method. As some linguists say maybe 6,000 years, others say 8,000-9,000 years, but certainly we cannot go terribly deep into history by this traditional method. So, why is this a problem? Well, first of all, it's a problem because we want to somehow to accept Jared Diamond's challenge, namely that we should pursue history for, say, 10,000 years, maybe even more. And this is one reason, and a conceptual one, but there is also another empirical reason. So if linguists, in the theoretical sense, are now challenged by ChatGPT, historical linguists are challenged by something else, which is somehow even more dangerous, or at least more deeply established as a scientific approach now, and that's population genetics and molecular anthropology. Namely, the fact that the discoveries about genetic markers and lately molecular markers, namely the direct study of the DNA of individuals and populations, has allowed geneticists to make very deep hypotheses about the origin and movements of human populations. So, for instance, if you look at this map from the Genographic Project, you can see that hypotheses about the biological split of human populations have been proposed up to 50,000 years ago, up to the time when, according to some molecular biologists, the first split between Africans and non-Africans took place with the first humans peopling Australia. And even some deeper splits have been postulated within Africa, which is the continent where most of the biological and probably also the linguistic diversification of humans has taken place. Okay, so this is a big challenge for us, because linguists may go back, say, 6,000 years or 7,000 years, and geneticists claim they can go back some 50,000 years, maybe even more. The important difference here is that linguists may usefully compare languages from what we call families, and families are recognized with this particular time limit, while geneticists, in principle, may compare the DNA of every pair of human beings. I'm saying this is true in principle, because in practice, the actual data which are available are not the same for all individuals, and especially for all populations. So the situation is a little bit like, I don't know, if linguists had the complete vocabulary of certain languages, the complete morphology of some other languages, the syntax of a third type of languages, and it is not really possible to have a global comparison which is really rich in data. But the progress in the study of the DNA is such that in a short time, geneticists will have a lot of data comparable across all human populations. Okay, so this is a challenge, this is also a sort of source of inspiration for us linguists. This work in population genetics, which has largely been started by work by Luca Cavalli-Sforza some 70, 75 years ago, represents an important model for what we could do. Because he took what we can call a shortcut, a short way from science to history. In order to satisfy the conditions, the general conditions which I suggested before, the best way would be taking something which is already a science and trying to use it to draw consequences about history. And this is exactly the big intuition by Cavalli-Sforza some 75 years ago. Essentially, the then modern biology, namely the discovery of genetic markers, even of pre-DNA genetic markers, was transferred into the study of the history of human populations. This was something which had not been really conceived before his work. And now we can think of something which could be analogous, namely, over the past 50 years, the study of formal linguistics, the study of what we call the generative biolinguistics, generative biolinguistic model, as part of the revolution in the cognitive sciences, has provided detailed models not only of universal principles of language, such as the ones Luigi has exposed for the past hour and a half, but also of the particular fashion in which different languages may differ in their syntax, in their grammatical structure. Okay, so over the past, I would say, 40 years, we've gone much beyond the idea that language differences are just differences in words. And now we have a model of how grammars, in particular the syntax of different languages, may vary. And one popular approach which stemmed out of Chomsky's research program in generative grammars, is that syntactic diversity can be largely reduced to points of binary variation. So two languages may differ because one language has, say, plus and another language has minus, or zero or one in a certain particular point, and point of its, well, let's say, of their syntactic rules. And this binary difference may produce a lot of apparently complex surface manifestations of language diversity. Okay, now just to give you an idea, we must consider that these points of binary differentiation, which are technically called parameters in linguistics, but for instance a geneticist would call them syntactic polymorphisms or dimorphisms, so points where languages may have one form or another form, and just one of these two. So these so-called parameters seem to recur language after language in few general types or formats. Okay, so just to give you some of the most recurrent formats, for instance, we can have languages which use grammatical features like person. So all Indo-European languages distinguish first person, second person, third person formally, and this has syntactic consequences. But for instance, Japanese and Korean don't. Okay? Or number. Okay? We Indo-Europeans use number in all sorts of ways, of obligatory ways. So ways that we can call grammaticalized in our languages, but for instance in Chinese there's no trace of this kind of phenomenon, and so on. And please consider one fact that these languages are as efficient in communication and everyday usage as Indo-European languages. Okay, so there's no difference in the functional effect of these abstract grammatical differences. Another type of difference which is quite recurrent across languages is if languages spell out certain categories, especially pronouns in their phonology, or may just use invisible, unpronounced elements to express the meaning of pronouns. Okay, this is a classical. A classical subject which has been studied in the 70s, in the 80s, especially by people like Tarleton, by Luigi himself, and it's well known that languages like French and English use more subject pronouns than languages like Italian and Spanish. Okay, and this kind of difference is found in other language families as well. Okay, and then another type of differentiation, which is a variation, which is found across languages, is that in certain languages, certain elements are displaced phonologically, are pronounced in positions which are different from the position where they are pronounced in other languages, but the actual logical interpretation remains the same. Okay, and this is very typical of question words, of the position of nouns, of the position of verbs. So in all of these cases, you can reduce the difference between pairs of languages to simple binary points like having or not having a certain property, say displacement, phonological representation, grammaticalization of a certain particular feature. Okay, so some 20 years ago I started to play around with the idea that maybe what Cavalli-Sforza had been doing in population genetics by using the universal comparability of genetic markers could be done in theoretical grammar by relying on the universal comparability of syntactic parameters, okay, of these binary points. So that languages could be, the syntax of languages could be somehow reduced to strings of binary values, and these strings could be collated and compared. And this kind of approach was called by myself and by my main collaborator in this enterprise, Professor Cristina Guardiano from the University of Reggio Emilia, the parametric comparison method. Okay. And so we started in the first decade of this century trying to show that this was technically possible, formally possible, and that this was potentially informative. So that the syntax of languages could be used to try to retrieve some kind of historical signal and basically to draw genealogical trees of languages without looking at the vocabulary, so at the lexical etymologies. Okay, this kind of approach looks relatively plausible and natural from the viewpoint of what I've just exposed, but it runs against a long tradition of skepticism in linguistics about the possibility that the syntax of languages may contain a historical signal. And this kind of skepticism began with the very beginning of comparative linguistics at the end of the 18th century, but it is remarkable how the same kind of skepticism, basically expressed in very similar words, has been repeated until the beginning of this century. So if you take this statement by Anderson and Lightfoot, they say that the English grammars might be more similar to grammars with which there is less historical connection. So the idea is that, well, maybe English is more similar to French than to German, and French is more similar to English than Italian. This is what they say. And they say there is no reason to believe that structural similarity should be even an approximate function of historical relatedness. Okay, so the basic idea is that the binary values of parameters are subject to chance distribution across time and space, and do not provide information about the history of languages. This is somehow the official position of linguistics, and as I said, you can find all sorts of quotes over the past 200 years claiming exactly this point, which has been repeated by historical linguists, by structural linguists, and even by generative linguists like Anderson and Lightfoot. Okay, but okay, what we want to show is that making this claim can be correct, actually is correct, if you take just one single parameter at a time. Okay, but this is not different from taking mucho and much and concluding that they do not prove anything about the relationship between Spanish and English. So this may be true on certain occasions, but the general pattern, so the systematicity of the comparison, may falsify the idea that syntax does not contain a historical signal, exactly like applying a regular method based on systematic sound correspondences can easily falsify the idea that the obviously false idea that English and Spanish are not related because mucho and much are accidentally similar and do not have a common etymology. Okay, so let's see what we can do to achieve this goal. Basically, what we should do in order to have a general systematic picture is trying to combine some tools of the recent quantitative revolution in historical linguistics, in phylogenetics, with a radical shift in the quality of the taxonomic characters which are used. Okay, so this is the basic idea. I will just give you a few pieces of information about the notion of parameter that we were using. There's an article which was published 3 years ago in an Italian journal, but it's in English, and provides a sort of introduction to the concept of parametric variation that we are adopting here. And what is most important in the online supplementary material, we provide a list and a short description of 94 parameters, so 94 syntactic dimorphisms, which have to do with the structure of noun phrases, and which have been and whose values have been set in about 60 different languages. So the idea is that every parameter has a sort of marked and unmarked value, and the marked value is the one which must be set from primary data in the course of language acquisition, and its conventional representation will be with a plus. So in principle, languages should be, from the viewpoint of the language learner, will be strings of pluses. From the viewpoint of the linguist who has to compare one language to another language, there will be strings of pluses and minuses. Okay, but actually, there's a third symbol which is important in this case, especially for comparison, and it's a symbol that we call zero. That basically means that certain properties in certain languages are completely predictable from the setting of the values of other parameters. Okay, so this adds to the complexity of the deductive structure of the system, but the concepts are quite similar. So languages, from the viewpoint of the comparative, the historical comparative linguist, are the syntax of languages are strings of plus, minuses, and zeros. Okay, and in order to compare them, we must look if at a certain point, so a certain locus of this kind of DNA of languages, you have an identity, so plus plus or minus minus, or a difference, plus minus minus plus. And if you have a zero in one of the two languages, this is sufficient to discard that point as a point of comparison. Okay, this is the basic idea. Notice that there are many zeros in the sense that the deductive structure of modern syntactic theory is very important, so that, for instance, in this set of about 60 languages and 94 parameters, we find over 45% of the values which are zeros. This is very important because this really states the difference between a surface approach, which just looks at the surface manifestations of parameters, and a theoretically informed approach, which only compares real points of cognitive difference between the syntax of two languages. Okay, now 45% of irrelevant information may have an important effect, maybe a real burden on a comparative approach which is only based on surface typology. Okay, now as a first approach, we should try to measure differences among languages. And in order to do so, we must choose between a huge number of possible distances. Okay, we've worked a lot with the colleagues in mathematics, at the mathematics department at the University of Trieste for many years. And in the end, we concluded, and also they concluded in separate articles, that several different kinds of distances provide basically the same historical effect. Okay, which means that there is a certain robustness which is intrinsic to the data, and that probably the simplest approach to measure distances among strings of syntactic of parametric values is what is called the Jacquard distance. Okay, this guy Jacquard was a botanist who at the beginning of the 20th century measured and classified the difference between various types of flora in the Jura. Okay. And his distance is called Jacquard distance. It's a distance which makes an idealization which is possibly relevant in our case. Namely, it takes only identities based on plus plus, so on positive marked values as relevant in order to calculate the distance between two languages. This gives a slightly better result than including also identities based on minus minus, so on default values, which is somehow a positive and slightly expected result given the fact that there is this asymmetry between marked and unmarked values in the presumably in the ontogenetics of languages, but then we can conclude also in the diachrony, in the phylogenetics of languages. Okay, so this is more or less the distribution of the languages we've considered. That there is one which is missing from the map, and that's Malagasy, simply because it's too southern in geographical distribution, and the colors roughly represent language families. Okay, the language families traditionally recognized on the basis of the classical comparative method, on the basis of lexia etymologies, are 15 in this domain. So across Eurasia, Malagasy can be considered a Eurasian language because it's an Austronesian language. So all Austronesian languages originate from Taiwan originally. Okay, and then what we did was feeding the set of distances among these languages to some algorithm which generates trees, and we got a tree which puts together all these languages from 15 different families. Okay, this is one of the most recent results. Now, what is important here with respect to classical methods? With classical methods, so all distances here are between 0 and 1, where 0 means complete identity and 1 means complete difference, of course. Now, if we try to use distances retrieved from lexical comparison, languages which do not belong to the same family would have a distance 1 by definition, so no common etymology, so complete difference. Instead, by the syntactic method, we can significantly compare languages which belong into different lexical etymological families. Now, then what we did was trying to test Anderson and Lightfoot's statement of skepticism about syntax as a signal of historical relatedness. And in order to do that, we just took the list of all the families and subfamilies which are recognized by classical lexical methods, by classical comparative methods, and we try to see how many of them were captured by the syntactic tree. And the result is that 88%, and we call this reference set of families and subfamilies the gold standard, okay? Which has no economic value in this case. I mean, it's just just a convention. And so we captured 88% of the gold standard through the syntactic tree. And the interesting point is that the 12% which we did not capture, it's basically located in just in two areas, it's clearly connected to areas where we know independently that important secondary areal contact and convergence has taken place on other linguistic levels. So these two areas are basically the area, the Balkans, where Bulgarian is recognized by its syntactic structure as part of the Slavic family, but as an outlier of the other languages of the family and not as part of the South Slavic subfamily. Okay, but we know that Bulgarian is in the middle of an area of intense secondary contact, namely the Balkan linguistic area, and we are actually able to identify which syntactic parameters of Bulgarian are different from the other Slavic languages, and they happen to have the same value as Romanian and Greek, so the two languages which are contiguous to Bulgarian. And the other point, which is basically recurrent in all our experiments, is the position of English, which seems to be slightly more similar to North Germanic, to Scandinavian, than to continental West Germanic than we might expect. But probably some of you know that, especially over the past 10 years, there has been a very, very strong debate about the actual classification of English as a West Germanic or North Germanic language after a famous book by Joseph Emmons, Jan Terje Forlund, who claimed that actually Middle English and, as a consequence, Modern English are a more direct offspring of Old Norse, as brought by the Vikings into the British Isles, than of Old English. Okay, this is a position which has been rebutted by many, many scholars, but at least a strong debate on this point is going on. So we're not particularly surprised by this syntactic result. Now, what did traditional historical linguists do once they discovered that, say, certain languages are more similar to others than they are to languages which are distant, which belong to other families? So when they, say, discovered the unity of Indo-European languages, well, of course, the first thing they did was trying to informally measure the degree of similarity. And this way, they were able to claim that certain languages are Indo-European because they are clearly very similar to each other, and that among these languages, some were Iranian, some were, say, Indo-Aryan, some were Romance, Germanic, and so on. But then, after that, after, say, some 20, 30 years, they began studying their similarities and differences in some detail, okay? And this way, they began reconstructing sound changes, particular sound changes in the history of languages. And they essentially proved or double proved somehow these hypotheses by showing that within certain families you can reconstruct changes step by step. Okay, so in principle, after building up trees on the basis of syntactic distances, one would like to apply more sophisticated algorithms which just take strings of characters and construct genealogical trees in terms of step-by-step reconstruction of the syntactic changes and of reconstruction of the various ancestral stages. Okay, so there are algorithms which do that or try to do that, but they are not particularly fit to the particular to the conditions, to the specific conditions of syntactic history, for a number of reasons. So, first of all, they cannot be very reliably used in order to compare languages from potentially different families. So they are not considered as heuristics for families for one reason, namely that all of these character-based algorithms are algorithms which one way or the other try to minimize the number of changes from the root of the tree, from the ancestor to the various daughters. To various daughter languages. But of course, if you're not sure that there is actually an ancestor, then all these calculations become very unreliable. This is one point. The second point is that we have zeros, and we have a lot of zeros. And these algorithms do not know exactly how to treat zeros. This is a problem which can only be in part remedied. And in order to do that, we actually coded zeros in as missing in information. Of course, this means that the algorithm will not reconstruct any zero, and at various stages, at least at the root stage of the tree, you probably want to reinsert zeros wherever they are predicted by the implications of linguistic theory. This can be done in a semi-automatic way. So it's a problem which is not solved. It can be partly controlled. And then the third problem is that these algorithms should be informed about something which begins to be obvious to linguists, namely the fact that in syntactic history, some parametric changes are very plausible and others are very implausible or completely unattested. So, for instance, in Eurasia, we know of many languages which have picked up definiteness, so developing a definite article and other devices of this type, but at least within Eurasia, we know of no case of the other type. Okay, so this is a kind of information that a character-based algorithm should be able to know, and so far we've been unable, to inform these algorithms about this particular point. This notwithstanding, we generated trees for at least the two families for which we are sure, independently sure, that there is a common ancestor, namely Indo-European and Finno-Ugric. Okay? Okay, I can show Finno-Ugric, at least the few Finno-Ugric languages that we have here. And what we obtained is trees which are very similar to the ones which have been produced by UPGMA, so by a distance-based based program. Actually, we obtain a number of gold standard nodes captured by the BEAST. BEAST is a character-based based program. The number of the percentage of gold standard nodes captured is almost 88%, almost 87.5%. So, essentially the same as we got from UPGMA, and the 12% is again related to the particular position of Bulgarian and of English. So, the result is robust to different types of algorithms, even from this viewpoint. Okay. I will come to this this conclusion now, what we call the homology conjecture. Namely, the idea is that, and this is the real falsification of Anderson and Lightfoot's position, namely, the empirical results seem to show that syntactic and lexical histories will provide the same evolutionary topologies once interference, so secondary convergence, is equally taken into account. Namely, the only cases where lexical history and syntactic history differ are cases where we know that some kind of borrowing interference or secondary convergence has taken place. Now, the fact that you don't see that in the classical trees is because all data which are similar as the product of borrowing have been removed from the input data to any kind of lexical classification. Okay, no one would say that Spanish, French, and Italian are related because all of these languages use the word abat-jour. Okay, because it's clear that it's a French word which has been borrowed into Spanish and Italian. So that would be eliminated, and historical linguists are even more sophisticated than that. For instance, they would eliminate the Italian word cavaliere, saying that at least part of it is a French borrowing, okay? Because Italian should have something like cavallaio or cavallaro. Okay. So there are sophisticated techniques to avoid any kind of effect of secondary convergence and borrowing on the lexicon. We do not have such techniques yet in syntax, so we expect exactly this minor divergence, this 12%. Okay, so now the second point that we want to discuss, the final point I would say, is whether we can use syntax to go deeper than other classical systems. Okay, and so we wrote an article a couple of years ago in collaboration with some mathematicians, which essentially tried to assess the statistical robustness of the nodes, the ancient nodes suggested by a UPGMA tree, the ones which go beyond the time depth of classical methods, so beyond the gold standard. Okay, and this is a non-trivial way, so you must invent something to do that. So what we did, I try to be brief on this. The basic idea was this. Let's take the constraints on the syntactic parameters. Let's take the 94 syntactic parameters we've been working with all the implicational constraints provided by linguistic theory, suggested by linguistic theory. Let's do some kind of statistics about the distribution of the values. So the frequency of the values of the various parameters across the different families that we know of. And on the basis of this, let's generate a huge number of possible languages. Okay? And of course, these possible languages may be compared to each other, so we can generate distances from these possible languages, and we can consider the distribution of these distances. And then, of course, we can decide that we have some significance thresholds, and we can try to see if some real distances are shorter than the distances that we would obtain by generating, randomly generating a number of artificial languages and artificial distances. Okay, so these are the two curves of real languages and artificial languages. Of course, they have been normalized in size because we have over 12 million artificial distances and 1,653 real distances. But what is interesting here is that, okay, what you see is this part here, I mean the one shaded in pale blue, which contains the real linguistic distances, language distances, which we find and which were not generated by the random generation mechanisms. So the kind of real world distances which are shorter than the expectation. Okay, this is the basic point. Okay, now, in order to simplify the general picture, I will show here distances not among languages, but among families, the average distances among families. Now, consider that if you take a threshold of 5% distribution of artificial languages, so the 5% shortest artificial language distances are below a threshold of 0.3. And 5% highest artificial distances are above a threshold of 0.7. Okay. Now you can see that the yellow distances are around 0.7 or slightly over 0.7, and there are no distances which are actually higher than chance, except these yellow ones. While if you take the green ones, you see distances which are slightly below the threshold of 0.3, but there are some, quite a few, which are much below. So for instance, you have distances like these ones, okay, which have to do basically with the subfamilies of what has sometimes been referred to as the micro-altaic hypothesis. And then you have Japanese and Korean here. And then you also have a very interesting average, low average distance between two North Caucasian languages and two Dravidian languages here. I will comment on that briefly later. And in the end, there is also some kind of suggestive evidence that Uralic and Altaic languages have an average syntactic distance which is slightly below the threshold. Now, okay, on the grounds of this, we can reproduce the general, global tree with the colors suggesting some groups which are at least worth better consideration in terms of long-range comparison. Of course, one group is the Indo-European languages, the red ones. Of course, Indo-European passes the test. And then the blue ones are Uralic, Altaic languages and Yukagir. And then you have Korean and Japanese here. And then you have the two Dravidian languages and the two North Caucasian languages, which are clustered together here. Okay, these are clusters which are robust enough to pass the test provided by the generation of artificial languages. Okay, this sums up the results in the sense sums up. The groups of languages which seem to pass the test and which are at least worth of more considerations in an attempt to long range and time deep comparison. Now I will finish by making some remarks about the kind of independent evidence which can or cannot be used in order to support this kind, at least these particular groups and these conclusions. And this is based on the idea that to some extent, in some areas of the world, linguistic variation, linguistic diversity, and genetic diversity, in our case, syntactic diversity and genetic diversity among the populations speaking those languages, may correlate to some extent. For instance, in an article that we published in the American Journal of Physical Anthropology a few years ago, we basically try to show that in Western Europe, Central and Western Europe, syntactic and genetic diversity correlate up to 60%, okay? Which is higher in that area than the correlation between genetic diversity and geographical distances. This is an interesting point in this area. Okay, then. This means that we can try, in some cases, only in some cases, to use genetic differences as a kind of potential correlate to deep syntactic variation. So, as for one case, Japanese and Korean, studies on modern DNA have revealed that Japanese and Korean speakers are genetically very similar. And this is exactly what we find, very strikingly, from the syntactic viewpoint, and the result goes beyond the much more controversial lexical relationship between the two languages. Okay, and then another consideration is that all languages of East Asia, so Japanese, Korean, Cantonese, Mandarin, to some extent Malagasy, which, as we said, ultimately comes from Taiwan, are very different from basically all the rest of Eurasian languages in their syntax. So there is a major divide there. Okay, and this major divide seems to correlate with some archaeological and ancient DNA analysis which have been recently produced, okay, which really divides populations which are, say, in Siberia, even in eastern Siberia, like Tungusic or people, Yakut-speaking people, from the real classical East Asia. And this is exactly something that we find in our syntactic classification. Then, most interestingly, we have this kind of similarity between Dravidian and some Caucasian languages. Okay? Now, Dravidian, of course, is spoken now in India, very marginal in Pakistan, but far away from the Caucasus. But the interesting thing is that modern Dravidian speakers, from the viewpoint of their DNA, have been shown to be very similar to ancient DNA found in human remains in western Iran, so immediately south of the Caucasus, basically where modern farming and modern domestication of certain animals began. And this may suggest that the vague idea that Dravidian languages may come from western Iran and from an area close to the Caucasus has something to recommend it, and the syntactic results that we have shows that at least this kind of relationship must be considered seriously from the linguistic viewpoint. Okay, there are some details which I will avoid. I will avoid this too. As for the relationship between Uralic and Altaic, it is impossible to support it through genetic data for reasons that we have already shown in another article, this Santos et al., where we show that already modern Finno-Ugric languages, which are scattered basically through Eastern, to Russia and Eastern Europe, display no genetic similarity in spite of their linguistic similarity. It's in every case they seem to share genes with their close neighbors, speakers of various Indo-European or Turkic languages, and they do not show a similarity of their own. This is the result probably of early dispersal of small groups of populations. Okay, finally, and this is really my final remark is about this notion of deep history that we may try to achieve. And this is a general consideration. So we all think that, we've been taught that Herodotus was the father of history, because he uses the word in the first line of his histories, although we don't understand then exactly the meaning of the word, and I wouldn't, I mean, as an expert of the structure of noun phrases, I will add that we don't know exactly how to parse the sentence. But anyway, that's another story. Anyway, he's the father of history in this sense. We also know that a few years later, Thucydides reacted very, very strongly against Herodotus' methods, considering them as primitive, as based on hearsay. And he said, instead I'm a serious historian, because I will tell you the story of particular things that I have seen. He used words which mean relying on evidence, seeing, something of which I'm an autoptic witness. Okay, and in particular the Peloponnese War, and of course he admitted that this kind of method had a failure, namely that he could not investigate more ancient facts because the time distance did not allow him to use his system. The system of witnessing, of listening to witnesses, and so on. Okay. Now, modern historians, Mark Bloch showed that very clearly, now do not really, I mean, know that even listening to direct witnesses is not a reliable way of doing history. He has proven that people just change their tales about even recent past events. But anyway, Thucydides opposed his way of doing history to Herodotus' way of doing that. But of course, this was, this basically involved the explicit loss of deep time history. Well, deep time history, however, is very important, and this is exactly what we want to do in order to find explanatory devices in history. And what I'm trying to suggest here is that using modern cognitive science like generative biolinguistics is precisely a way to pursue this objective of deep time history. And in a sense, it converges with an approach that the Harvard historian Daniel Lord-Smale has called deep history based on the study of neurocognitive features of human beings. Okay, and in this sense, I think that the parametric comparison method is a tool in this direction, and it is a sort of, this is what I call the Clausewitz principle applied to comparative linguistics. The PCM wants to be the continuation of the historical comparative paradigm by other means. Thank you very much.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.